Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm joined today by the author of Hotwired Style.
That was 20 years ago.
It's as fresh in my mind as ever. Jeffine is the author of The Art and Science of Web Design, which was a huge book for a lot of us, and Hotwired Style, which was 20 years ago, and maybe better known to you, to listeners, as the co-founder of Adaptive Path, co-founder of Typekit, co-creator of MeasureMap, a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's been a busy 20 years.
Your original rise to fame, which I think happened when you were like 21 or 22, was you were using Debabilizer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I would totally encourage all of your listeners who aren't familiar with Debabilizer to do a search for it and then switch to Google Images and have a look at the UI of Debabilizer. It was one of the most powerful and perplexing graphic manipulation tools I've ever encountered in my life.
Sad. It says, "Did you mean Debabilizer?" That's how long it's been. Oh, there's a free download.
Apparently, it's still a piece of software after 20 years. But to back up, yeah, that was hilarious. I went to, gosh, I don't even know what the web conference was back then. I don't even think it was a web conference. I think it was like a design conference, mostly for print.
Or a computer conference or
something. And then they had like two sessions about this new web thing.
Right.
And I met with this company that made this amazing piece of software that I had already been using. It was called Debabilizer. And this is like Photoshop 2.0 is out at the time, right? And it was just a pure file conversion. So we could turn things in like from Photoshop files into GIFs that had the web safe color palette. And it was a very technical piece of software. Anyway, I sat down, they showed me this new version, and I was like, wow, that's amazing. And they're like, wow, cool, thank you. Can we quote you? And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. And they put it on the box. Right? Like that was back when you bought software in a box.
In a box.
And they put my quote on the box.
It said Jeff Veen of Hotwired?
Probably, Wired or Hotwired or something like that.
Which was in 1994, one of the first content sites that wasn't like a scientist writing to another scientist, but
certainly among a handful of the first commercial websites. And that was, you know, we had ad banners and whatnot. Yeah. Yeah.
You had four incomprehensible icons on the front cover, which, like there was a one-eyed man or so. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah. Incomprehensible.
and a whole design style that came out of 16 colors.
Right.
Right, so everything was pixelated, so it would render as a GIF, right? There was no intermediate, right? So, like circles were basically like big icons of circles. It was great. It was such an amazing time to be alive, and so exciting, as is now. But you know, as is every day that we're not dead. But it was really exciting those beginning times. So did they take a picture of you using the product?
No. Go ahead.
I just always picture, when I heard that story, I thought of like Wheaties with an athlete on the front. I pictured you like holding a box of Debabilizer with a cereal bowl. I don't know why.
That's right. It got me to where I am today, kids.
That might have been the first. The other thing I remember was Heather Champ appearing in Women of the Web That We Love in Esquire or something, in kind of a fashion spread, kind of a sexy fashion spread. Yep. Heather Champ, now a farmer, but a hugely storied web career.
Oh, huge. Well, her and Derek in the history of the web.
Absolutely.
Now in Portland raising chickens, I think.
Which is cool.
Yeah, of course. I think we all kind of long for the opportunity to go on and offline in different phases with where our heads are at, for sure.
Since you've just, you and Brian Mason and several other people, you created Typekit and you brought it to Adobe and then you had a big role at Adobe and now you're, the last few months you've been kind of on your own. Are you thinking about raising chickens? Are you thinking about writing another book? Like every 20 years, a new book? What?
Every 20 years, whether I need it or not. Right. Yeah. No, I actually, I've started doing something new, that's a little bit different from what I've done in the past. So, you mentioned Typekit. That was, like a tremendous amount of fun. And we took it pretty far and went through an acquisition. We did that. One of the mechanisms we used to grow Typekit was that we took venture capital and raised some money and kind of did that. Like, we went down the path that many Silicon Valley companies do.
Scary? Was that your first time doing that?
It was the first time successfully doing that.
Okay.
Sure. It is scary because there's no textbook. There's no like tutorial online that you go read to figure out how to do this.
Because you haven't written that book. Nobody's nobody who's done that has written that book.
And not from like a truly inexperienced entrepreneurial point of view, right? Somebody who's thinking, I want to go do that. I hear about this. I read TechCrunch. I do whatever. I think that might be a path I want to do. Yeah, I still think that it is by and large something that you have to throw yourself into and learn on the fly. There are certainly, I think, a lot more resources available now, blog posts and, you know, there's people like Josh Koppelman or Brad Feld who are these, you know, sort of fantastic and experienced seed stage investors who have written a lot about this stuff. But then there wasn't. And so one of the decisions that we had to make was who we were going to use as investors. And we went with a company called True Ventures. And we did so for a whole bunch of reasons. We liked them a lot. They were very focused on the small, early stage, very creative companies, all of that thing. There was a great community of founders that they were already working with that we were able to get together with and talk to all the time when we had questions. So it was a wonderful learning experience and all of that. All of this is to say that I have joined them now as a partner, focused on design throughout the portfolio, as well as looking for new kind of design focused or designer led companies to invest in. So I am sort of sitting on the other side of the table now.
It's interesting. What you're describing in a strange way maps to like at a certain point, so a designer is a maker early in their career, and they're a maker, and they're a maker, and they're a maker. And then eventually, in many design careers, they become a manager. They become an executive. Or they become somebody who helps other makers. You know, they look at other people's work and evaluate it. It's like right. A creative director in advertising, a design director at a company usually isn't designing. They're looking at other people's work. And it sounds like you're doing the same thing in this new, to me anyway, new world, this new, you know, this new career path.
Yeah.
Which is still a maker career path and still a design career path. Everything absolutely. You've done is design.
Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah.
I think you were one of the first people that made me realize like design applies to a lot of stuff, you know, beyond Photoshop, right? Design is the whole experience.
That's right.
You started a company. You and some friends started a company, what is it, 12, 15 years ago, Adaptive Path?
Yeah, that was about 12 years ago. Yeah, you're right.
And that was one of the first user experience consultancies that I'd ever heard of.
Right. So I think it was a broader approach to what people thought of as a design agency. Mm-hmm. Still very much in the tradition of the, you know, professional services, doing, you know, making proposals and pitching projects and working with clients and all that kind of stuff. But the other thing that we did, I think that was a little bit different, was that we also kind of diverged into product development ourselves, right?
Yeah.
There was kind of a trend, a micro trend, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's not even a trend. 37 Signals did it. So
37
we did
Signals,
it too.
Kudal, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Jim and those guys did it as well. There's this, yeah. One of the things you learn, which you have probably seen in your career as well, Jeffrey, is that when you're doing design consulting, design as a professional service, that it is the financial reward for doing that is dependent directly on the amount of time that you are billing, right? So there's this essentially this endless treadmill. Whereas in product development, there's a lot more risk involved, but there's more a potential upside, more right, that you right. can put a tremendous amount of effort into a particular product. And at some point, it will kind of keep growing. You obviously, there's maintenance and there's future development and there's stuff like that. But it's a process of building on top of the work you've done in the past.
But also, the rewards are incommensurate between the two things. So as an example, we once made $90,000 doing a redesign for a very well-known web-based product. And under the surface, it was a cluster cuss. It was a complete mess. The technology was like completely fragile. It was all done with like server side includes, and this was like 8 years ago. Yeah. Right, the whole thing was based on server side includes, and a lot of stuff was done manually. And this was one of the most visited websites in the world. Right, and they had like 20 million people visiting an hour or some crazy thing. And anyway, we made $90,000, and we did, you know, information architecture, as we used to call it, UX, yeah. design, templates, back end, everything. And then they sold it for $20 million like a month later. And I was like, you know, they had like, they're the founders. They had the idea and they've kept it going all this time. So, you know, right on, more power to them. But at the same time, I had this feeling like somehow our work, $90,000 that had seemed huge to me now seemed pitiful. Somehow that tiny, pitiful $90,000 that I had to divide between like 15 people, you know, sure. over the course of months, right? So really isn't that much once you start looking at all the – that had somehow made it possible, had maybe increased by 10, you know, by $10 million the value of the product, or made it feasible for them to sell it. So I know that feeling from both sides.
Yeah. And that's also because there was a rationality to how you price your services, right?
On the hours, like you said, or on the project.
Of course. So you take a look at basically your cost of living, what you think your expected salary is, you know, what's reasonable for somebody of your skill and experience. You divide that up into the number of hours you potentially can bill in a year. And there you go, right? Like then you barter and negotiate and get to that point with your clients. That's all very rational. I think a lot of times there is what we could call it irrational. We could call it more strategic, way of valuing a lot of the products and companies, that are the result of the technology that we have today.
Yeah. I've always had a product, right? Because as soon as I started designing websites, I had a completely useless product, a personal site. But then a couple of years later, I had a list apart, and it was like, you know, wasn't a money making product, but it was to me the joy of just having something that you could keep refining and stay engaged with and build a community around.
Right?
You know, I always loved that, and I always got that designers can be entrepreneurs. I didn't get the part where, you know, there's an end game and all that stuff. I've only slowly begun to figure that out over the years. But I always loved the part about making this just for me or just for the people who like it, going to follow my own gut instinct. I mean, you and I had a conversation a while ago about scratching your own itch.
Right.
Because a lot of people would say, if it's not design, if it's not about the user, it's not design, if it's not based on research. And I think you said that's often true, but sometimes – like 37 Signals is the canonical example. You just make something because you need that product, and you've done that several times, right?
Yeah, that's true. Though, look, a big chunk of my career, especially the work we did at Adaptive Path, was based around the premise of user research. So it's not necessarily mm-hmm. to say that now I don't believe in research. I just build stuff for myself.
Right.
I think it's a little more nuanced than that.
Right.
We used to, like, I had projects in the past when I was at Adaptive Path, like a decade ago, I designed the point tracker for weightwatchers.com, which was not a product that I used or would use. I was certainly not in the demographic for it, right? It was very much outside of my experience. So it took for us to do a good job on that, a tremendous amount of like interviews and needs analysis and lots of contextual inquiry, and then a bunch of prototyping with usability testing and all of those sorts of research methodologies to try to understand the needs and fears and desires of the people that would be using that product.
Now, for me, it was Tam Brands.
Yeah.
And it was like, I know what it does, but I'm never going to use it. So, yeah.
But I think a lot of people think of that research, that phase of research that you go through when you're doing all of this as, I'm just going to look and listen to people and then kind of draw what I think they need and give it to them. Mm-hmm. Whereas I see that research today, I still do a lot of that kind of research as a way to become myself more like the person that's going to end up using this, so that I can continue to design something that resonates with me, but hopefully I have, through enough observation and empathy, become more like the person who's going to use it, so that if it resonates for me, it'll resonate for them. See, I think that's a shift in how I have always thought, at least, about user research, as a, you know, rather than the set of techniques that you go through that ends in a result, it's a set of techniques that I go through to change me.
It sounds like a different way of understanding empathy.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
That's kind of what empathy is, right?
Right.
That you, right, in a sense, become that person. Yeah. It's like when you watch The Sopranos and identify with Tony Soprano, even though you're not a killer.
Right.
It's because you're finding that actor is conveying the humanity, and the writers have put in stuff to trip you up and make you see the common humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean,
I think that's a really good point.
Is there, when you were at Adaptive Path, when you guys were building your consultancy, were there ever products you just said, I'm not going to work on that because you didn't like the people who made the stuff, or you thought I could never empathize? I don't know if it was like a thing that killed kittens. Let's say it was a product that killed kittens. You know, I don't want to know what it's like to be someone who kills kittens. So I'm not gonna, I mean, were there things like that?
There certainly were. We had kind of a standing rule. One of our values between the partners of Adaptive Path was that we would not take work that we wouldn't be proud showcasing. So we wanted to make sure that any work that we took for whichever client it was, that we could stand on a stage and show the work and say, we did this and we're proud of it. Publish a blog post saying, look at this new thing that's launched. We made this and we're proud of it. And there were plenty of clients that came to us where we were like, the set of products that you make is not something that we can in good conscience stand behind. So there were, and it's a handful.
But right? sometimes things go wrong. I found it really instructive. You guys worked on a project, like at the height of blogging, for a company that measured the influence of blogs and blogging. And at the time that you were working on this, and I heard a little bit about it from you and some of the people you work with, a friend of mine, Tontek, was also inside the company.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And there was this, he did a thing that he didn't like the HTML. He decided to rewrite the HTML because he's a standards geek. But while he was at it, he started changing the design because he didn't understand that, like, what you're supposed to do as a client is say, I don't feel it's doing such and such, or I'm having a problem with this. But, you know, I think he was trying to fix it the way people often do, because nobody goes to client school. They don't know how to be clients.
Right.
Anyway, so he made buttons bigger, whatever. So the thing, when it was done, was not what you had brought to him. And what I noticed is that you wrote this really nice blog post. In fact, I think it's probably at veen.com/Jeff somewhere. Or it might be on Adaptive Path's blog somewhere. But you wrote this really nice post talking about how great this company was, the important work that they did, how proud you were to have been selected by them. And then you talked about some specific business problems that they needed the website to help address and how you would approach those. And you didn't show pictures of the site or really direct people to look at the site, but you didn't. It's like you were proud of what you could be proud of, and very classy about the way you handled it. And we've had to do that. I've had to do that with my studio once or twice where something was really good, but it wasn't what we had hoped for, you know, because management changed three times over the 2 years that we were engaged. And, you know, by the time you're done, the business strategy changed seven times. So we took a page from your book and focused on this one thing that we'd made work much better. It's one thing that was very important to their business and how we'd improved that experience. And that's what you do.
And that's one of the frustrations, at least for me, of doing client work, was that there was so much of the end result that was outside of your control. That you could do the best work you could possibly do for the client, but you're not the one with your finger on the button that launches the final result. And it could go through so many different constraints that could crop up that were never part of the scope of what you were working on, that there's a lot of times when even though your values align with the client and you feel like the work you've done is really, really solid, that the end result is not something you're proud of, simply because you couldn't... You weren't in a position to see it all the way through. And I think this has been, I think that's the history of design as a service and the frustration that comes with it sometimes.
Sometimes you delivered it, you went on site, you trained everyone, you really like were as hands-on as you could be. But 6 months later, it's not what you gave them. And 6 months later, the people that you were working for aren't there anymore. And even though you said, here's a style guide, here's how to evolve, come back to us, maybe that none of that happened. So that's the way it is. There's nothing, there's nothing that we work in sand.
Right? That's right. That's the way it is. And that's ultimately why I left consulting to do product development, because I wanted a few things. I wanted to have that control over the entire process. And I wanted to have the time to iterate and really get to know an audience and build a community around a product in a way that you can never do even with a 16-week engagement with some, you know, with a client. Even in the biggest ones, like nobody hires a consultant to do the work for 2 or 3 or 4 years. And that's what I think it takes to get products to some level of maturity, even in our incredibly iterative and rapid pace that we work at today.
Unless you get the kind of engagement which we're starting to look at where you actually you don't do projects at all, you kind of hire on. A friend of mine described it as partial CTO. You become you sort of engage. Part of your time will now be spent, it's kind of like a retainer agreement.
Yeah,
and there's a certain number of hours, but you become a strategic partner, and you're constantly iterating, and you may be involved for 3 or 4 years.
I think all of this is part of a larger trend of more and more design services coming in-house rather than using agencies to do them. And I think we've certainly seen that over here on the West Coast in Silicon Valley, and agency after agency being acquired by companies that aren't agencies.
Right.
To get that head start on having a highly functioning design team brought in house. And so they'll do an acquisition and they'll buy one and they'll stop doing client work and they'll all move into Facebook or wherever and they'll get to work on the products. And I think what that points to is overall the value that's being placed on design now in the tech industry. Mm-hmm. That how the tech industry is, the perception is that design is of such a critical importance now, we couldn't even imagine hiring it out. I mean, you could imagine, right, that when Google was getting started, they weren't going to hire consultants to help them figure out their search algorithm.
Right.
Like that's core competency. That's absolutely the right at the nucleus of what they do. And now design has, I think, finally... this overnight sensation we've been working on for 20 years has become at that level of importance.
It's
tough. People are acknowledging that, like, I can't just hire a designer for 6 weeks to help me with some design work. I need that to be in-house here every day, all the time, forever.
Although there is something for young designers there's something really wonderful about working at a studio and having different projects, working on three or four completely different projects at a time and doing that for 5 or 6 years under, you know, beside colleagues who are equally talented and yeah. with working with more seasoned people. And you miss that. I teach in the MFA program in interaction design at School of Visual Arts one night a week. And the students are amazing. And they're about to, my current students are about to leave with their MFAs. There's 21 of them, and something like 18 of them already have jobs in San Francisco at big tech companies. They're uh-huh. not going into studios. It's like, and part of that's because it's interaction design, and it's kind of, you know, it kind of makes sense to work on a product community. But I think that's what designers, young designers, are interested in now. They're interested in not just because of money, but they're interested in solving long-term product problems and, you know, diving deep on something. And it's wonderful and terrible. It's wonderful to see design be this important, but it's also sad in the way that, do you remember talking about Photoshop? And now that Photoshop is in the cloud, nobody can steal it. And yeah. in a way, that's kind of sad because everybody stole it first and then became lifelong customers.
Right.
Like everybody stole their first fonts and then never stole again, hopefully.
Right.
And it's like people aren't, it's going to be harder for designers to get that training, that sort of rough and tumble training that you get when you're in the services business.
That's right. And I think there's two parts to that. One is the diversity that you mentioned, right? Working on such a broad range of design problems gives you a level of experience where, you know, later in your career, you can say, I've seen this problem before.
Right.
But the other part of that is that I think the young designer in the studio with the experienced creative director sets up a sort of apprentice mentor relationship that I still feel is crucial to help bring up, frankly, anybody in the various disciplines of what we do, but certainly with designers. That's certainly how I started my career.
Right. Where did you start?
Well, I started. See, I'm very old, Jeffrey. I started my career before there was a web. I graduated from college in like 1991. And I worked at newspapers. I was a journalist, but with a deep, like geekiness around the technology. So I, for a couple of years, I had this job where it was a small newspaper, you know, one of those community weekly newspapers where it's Little League scores and car crashes and, you know, things like that. Right. And, not only did I write and report and edit, but I also then spent a couple days a week laying out the newspaper in Cork Express on a Mac SE30 with a giant black and like a 1-bit monitor, like way back, right? Like all that stuff. And I learned from the managing editor who was in charge of the whole thing, just like how to do all that, how to write a story in the inverted pyramid style, how to lay out a newspaper to show visual hierarchy, like the whole range of stuff. Was a very experienced woman who would take no crap from anybody and would basically bark out orders at us. And I learned, man, I really learned. And from there, I got the job at Wired Magazine, where I was essentially the design assistant to the creative director for all the online properties.
Wow.
So I would, and I remember very early days when I got there, it was a woman named Barbara Kaur, and she was a remarkable designer, but none of us had ever worked on the web, and I had some web familiarity in 1994, which was very rare, and she like pointed at me and said, you sit here in my office. You sit on that side of the desk. I'll sit on this side. We're going to build this thing. And I just watched her iterate and iterate and iterate. And I kind of sat next to her typing HTML into BBEdit as fast as I possibly could, trying to reproduce what she was designing in Illustrator.
Mm.
And I did that for, literally 12 hours a day for 2 years. And then, it's a little bit like, you know, what you hear about.
And then made image maps?
And made image maps and server side push for animation, like all of those ancient things.
I did that too.
And it's a little bit like what you hear in a Japanese sushi restaurant, where for the first year, you only do rice. And then for the second year, you get to do some rolls. And on the in the third year, you get to have a knife.
Have you seen, there's a wonderful film by a crazy German director about Ozu. It's a wonderful German director, but also mad. Like, they all went mad filming. Gosh, I forget the name of the film. Anyway, that, I'm sorry that I'm forgetting that part.
But like Apocalypse Now, where everyone
was
went
like
insane.
It was like that. It was a story like that, but it was all German actors. So when they were in South America, so really pretty crazy. But he made this film about Ozu, and Ozu's cameraman worked for Ozu for 40 years, never, and simply set up the shot according to Ozu's specifications. Ozu's camera never moved, and it was always a 40 millimeter lens, and it was always set two thirds, like almost to chest height, as if someone was seated in a lotus position watching the action, most of which took place on the floor and was dialogue. And the guy tells this story, the cameraman tells the story of how one day after he'd been working for Ozu for 20 years, he came to Ozu and said, I'd like to try a 50 millimeter lens. And Ozu said, go ahead, and let him set it up. And then Ozu looked through it and said, you see, the 40 is better. And they went back to the 40 and he never brought it up again. And he cried saying this. Now, an American would be crying because he was so frustrated.
Right.
But this guy was crying because he was so touched that the master, Ozu, actually once let him, a cameraman, set up a shot.
Right.
To his own. So it's a completely different world.
Absolutely. And think about that relationship, right? Like you said earlier that you noticed in your career and what's happening around that at a certain point, designers stop practicing the craft as much and become managers. But think about that relationship that you just described or what I was talking about with like the sushi chef or even what I was doing sitting at Barbara's desk designing. I don't think that's management. I think that's leadership.
Right.
I think that's somebody experienced and somebody young doing work together and taking on different parts and a constant feedback loop and dialogue that corrects the younger person in their skills and craft to hone them into eventually becoming a master of what they do.
See, and I think we're both parents.
Parenting
is the hardest work I do. It's the most creative work I do, most satisfying work I do. And you could say you just sat on the couch while your kid was reading. Well, you weren't doing anything. It's like, but on the contrary, that was the most important work I did that day. And
yeah.
It was profound. And it was, even if you only said two sentences, it was the two sentences that child needed to hear right then.
Yeah. No, I think about that all the time. I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and by and large, I'm getting them to almost entirely cook dinner now.
But wow.
I'm standing right there and I'm doing just little bits and pieces they're not ready for. And it's constant correction and it's all of that. But those two, and I'll tell you what, that's like this total parenting hack. Kids will eat food they cook, but they won't eat anything else. So, and we're not just having grilled cheese. Like we're making, you know, like a nice chicken going a dish with vegetables and they're chopping and they're, you know, just starting to learn to saute and stuff like that. So it's, But I totally agree with you. That's not management, right? It's a different thing, and it's a thing that I think can often be lacking for the young interaction design student that just gets a job at Facebook, or if they do. And I'm not calling out Facebook. I actually have dear friends who are design directors over there. But I think it's a much more rare situation than if you get a job and you're on a product team and you've got to make. You know, you're in charge of monetization and so make the ads more attractive or whatever.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very different. And that's sort of the feedback. It's hard to find a relationship in a situation like that. The circumstances are rare, but that's feedback I often give to people younger in their career. Try to find somebody that you can work for who will make you better.
Yeah. That's good for advice for people later in their career too. Try to find people who have more fire in their belly for the thing you used to do than you do now, but whom you can work with in this mentoring way.
And it goes both ways.
Yeah.
When I'm hiring people, I try to fall back on the confidence of what I know and what I'm good at and the confidence of what I know I'm not good at and hire people who are better at me at the things I'm not good at, which I think in a lot of cases, people are very apprehensive of doing that simply because they feel like they will lose their position of authority. But if you can own what you don't know and hire to fill those gaps, and I think it's a tremendous advantage in making everybody better at what they do.
Well, Orson Welles, if you believe him, said how he directed was he hired the best screenwriter he could, the best actors he could, the best composer he could, and the best cinematographer he could, and the best editor, and then he just stood out of the way.
Get out of the way, because they're going to do amazing work.
I find it hard to believe Orson Welles really got out of the way, but... You're a natural teacher. I want to tell you a story you probably don't remember. You and I were speaking at Web Design World Denver in 2000 or 2001. Another of the speakers was Josh Davis, who was sort of ended up taking us all around because he'd grown up in Denver. And he said, here's the haunted hotel and all this stuff. But first night, you and I were the first speakers to arrive. And you said, let's go out to dinner. And we went to some diner. And I pulled out this big booklet that I had in my backpack. And you said, what is that? And I said, that's my speech for tomorrow. Do you remember this?
I do, yeah.
And you said, throw that away. That's just tell stories. I looked at it and you know, just tell stories. And I did. I threw it away. I was terrified. I threw it away and I did improv and it worked. And that's what I do now. And it's all because of you. And it was, you had the confidence to tell me that, not like, you know, you might want to consider. You just said it like you were a Zen master. You just, here it is. Here's the wisdom. And you were very confident and I believed you. And I saw that that's how you spoke. And I've always done that. In fact, last year I tried as an experiment to write my speech in advance again. Representation I was doing all year. And it was okay. It was nice to sort of get all the thoughts down in writing. But man, it was stiff. It was only after I'd given it a few times and forgotten the words that I then went back to just sort of reading the audience and spinning stories that would help them get to a, you know, understand the point. If I hadn't made the point, really, if I could see it, I hadn't made the point, pull in another story, all that stuff you get to do if you just have a rough idea of where you're going. And you are a master of that.
Well, a rough idea of where you're going and decades of experience and practice to fall back on. Like if you go see jazz players doing improv,
right?
It's not like they picked up the clarinet yesterday,
right?
I think so. Like, I still have a process when I do a talk where I figure out what stories I want to tell and I type them out. I type it all the way through. I get all of it out of me and then I never look at it again. The act of typing it slows my brain down and forces me through all the details and all of the editing and gives me confidence that when I start, I know where it's going to end. But I don't need all the stuff in the middle once I've written it all out. Then I throw that away and I never look at it again. And I get up on stage and just tell the story to the audience.
Well, that's also that thing when you connect your verbal thinking with your written thinking.
Yeah.
I took notes in college that I never looked at. But I always took wonderful notes. I got really nice notebooks. I took them, you know, best I could. And I didn't even go back and like make sure I understood. I just never looked at them again. But I remembered what I'd written.
It's like the journey is the destination, right? Like writing it down is what helps you to remember, not having it there to go memorize again later or something.
At least that's how it works. Skills too. I think it's there's some kind of hand coordination, right? It's like you're building muscle memory.
Memory. Some deep evolutionary trait that we've developed that in some way it slows us down and it takes us out of just the little voice in our head that's talking to us all the time and makes us process it in a different way. I don't know what it is. There's probably a lot of science about it. And your very intelligent listeners will let us know what that all is. But I'm sure, at least from my own experience, that's the way it's part of the creative process for me.
So if a listener has a design idea or a design company, a startup, and they say, I'd like to go talk to Jeffrey Bean and his colleagues at, the name of the company. True Ventures, right. What are you looking for?
We're looking for a lot of stuff. And there's two ways to think about that question. One is what is the content area? What is the subject matter? And that's all over the board. And it's very much, you know, there's seven partners and it's all very much based on the interest and expertise and history experience of each one of the partners. There's one that's very much into biology and gene science and the biome and stuff like that. There's another that's very, very much into developer tools and the full stack and enterprise SaaS models and things like that. As you can imagine, I've spent my whole career working on the tools that that designers and developers use to make the products that we use every day. So Typekit is a perfect example of that. MeasureApp was an example of that. Google Analytics was an example of that. Every single thing I worked on at Adobe were the tools that... that we use, that our community uses to make the stuff that the world consumes. Because I think the people who make this stuff are the most powerful people in the world. So I'm looking at those kinds of tools as one thing. Another thing that I really like, though, besides the content area, are teams that you know will find something that works, even if they're just getting started and scratching around right now.
Yes, that makes sense.
And so you look at, it's a little bit of a pedigree. What have you done in the past, right? How do I know that you're the kind of person that will not stop until you get there? What have you done already? So it's very rare, even at the earliest stage when it's two or three people in the company, only the founders, it's very rare that there isn't already a functioning prototype, very likely with some users already, because it does not take millions of dollars to make a thing.
Right.
It makes millions of dollars to scale a thing still, but not to make it.
Right.
And to show the promise of what we're doing, of where we're heading, you want to have a look. Like, I think that that's a prerequisite now before even raising money, by and large, especially for teams that haven't done it multiple times in the past.
People can find you at veen.com/Jeff.
Yeah, Twitter's the best place.
Twitter's the best place.
Yeah,
Veen.
Veen. Just my last name. Because blogs are hard to maintain, Jeffrey. Boy, you're the only one I know who has ever done it with any length of time.
Yeah, I don't really. Not like it was. It was a great thing in its day. I want to thank you for today. It's been really wonderful speaking with you.
This is super fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.